My guest today is quite an accomplished man. After serving in the Vietnam War, he was elected to the United States House of Representatives at the age of 28. Over the next 16 years, he served in both houses of Congress, representing the gray people of the volunteer state of Tennessee. During his time in Congress, he championed many pieces of legislation, most notably the Supercomputer Network Study Act of 1986. And his successes with that bill have led many to support his claim that he created the internet. After his time in Congress, he then went on to become the 45th Vice President of these United States. And after the now infamous 2000 presidential election, which he lost to George Bush, he went on to be the leader in environmental policy discussion, swaying it to the forefront of the conversation in the public forum. His documentary, An Inconvenient Truth, helped earn him the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize. And also in 2007, he was the first runner-up for Time Magazine's Person of the Year. He's won a Grammy and an Emmy. And it would have been with great pleasure that I introduce the former Vice President of the United States, Mr. Al Gore.
Let's see if we can't get my brilliant buddy Malcolm on the phone.
Hello? Hello?
Hey, Malcolm.
Oh, hey, Chad. Did Al Gore not show up?
He didn't.
No.
You know, I sent an email to him last week. I thought he was going to show up.
Ah, that's all right. I watched An Inconvenient Truth and skimmed his Wikipedia, so I think I can answer whatever questions you might have had for him. I'm ready if you want to.
It's awesome. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. I suppose a good place as any to start is, there's a meme. I saw a meme saying that Al Gore stole from a little old lady.
Yeah. I heard he stole from a nice little old lady who rescued Jews in the Holocaust. And then he went and stole her Nobel Peace Prize medal or something like that.
That's super interesting. This old lady who back in World War II actually helped save over 2,500 people, 2,500 children from Nazi oppression and occupation in Warsaw, Poland. 2,500 people. And in 2007, she was one of the runner-ups. Runners-up for the Nobel Peace Prize. And she ended up not winning the award, and it went to Al Gore.
Yeah. Feels like whoever's running My Brilliant Buddies Facebook page at mybrilliantbuddies@facebook.com is really just trying to drum up follows and likes and support on their page.
Sure.
You have feedback on it, please go to mybrilliantbuddies@facebook.com and let us know. Or send us an email at mybrilliantbuddies@gmail.com.
Yeah, it just feels as though that woman was much more deserving.
Then this, I've looked her up, this Irvina Sedler, one of the other nominees that year, who, oh gosh, she died the next year and never got an award. I can see how it would feel like she was more deserving, but, I mean, what she did was incredible, but she did it in, like, the 1930s, 1940s, and so if she hasn't gotten the award by 2007, you know, it's not just Al Gore's fault. There were many, every year she was passed up. What she did was super incredible. My gosh, yeah, almost 3,000 children that she saved from concentration camps. But I know one of the other Nobel Peace Prize winners, who is it? When he was Secretary of State, sent he was Secretary of State during the Second World War, and a boat full of Jewish refugees tried to come to America, and he sent them back to Germany, where 250, left of them died. Yeah.
That man won the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah. Obviously not for that act, but for other actions.
Yeah, sure. Who was that? Was that Kissinger?
No, Kissinger, he was accused of committing war crimes in Cambodia from like 69 to 75 and 73. So like the middle of that, while he's committing war crimes in Cambodia, he won a Nobel Peace Prize for promoting peace in Vietnam. This was 2 years before the end of the Vietnam War that he won a peace prize for peace in Vietnam while committing war crimes. I don't know. That was Kissinger. I am looking through my notes for the theory right now, and I cannot find the name.
The Secretary of State that won it in the 1930s, like during World War II?
Yeah.
That's absurd.
Cordell Hull. Yeah, he won in 45, and in 39 he sent 1,000 Jews back to Nazi Germany.
20 and like a quarter of them got slaughtered.
Yes. And he won 6 years later. I'm sorry. Aung San Suu Kyi in 1991 won for her work opposing the Myanmar military dictatorship. She is now the head of Myanmar's military dictatorship, currently committing genocide against the Rohingya. And she is a winner of the prize.
I wonder, it's just, like, the Nobel Prize, these are not people who are promoting peace. Like, this woman, Irina Sendler, little old lady, she's wrinkly, but before she was all wrinkly, she was saving Jewish children, 2,500 of them. Just feels as though that's theft. It feels like stealing to me. What do you think?
The prize itself feels definitely not cheap, but a little bit two-faced. You know, Nobel, the fellow the prize is named after, he created the Nobel Peace Prize in order to try and promote peace around the world because he read his own obituary. The newspaper thought he was dead and printed an obituary, and in it they called him the Merchant of Death because he invented dynamite and led to the death of so many people. And so, like, he felt so bad for leading to the death of so many people that he created this prize that now seems to go to people who, like, did some stuff they feel bad about, and the politicians that be give him a big pat on the back. Like, there, you tried, son. Here you go. I mean, Obama won his peace prize after 12 days in office. He was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize.
It really feels as though those people actually won in the spirit of the thing. You know, that maybe Irina never, like, this lovely old woman who saved these children from the Nazis, like, this prize never really was created to highlight extraordinary acts by ordinary people. Kind of how it feels.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know what prize sounds to me like? It was established for, like, people who repaired the world, per se, or did something good, is the Irina Sendler Award for people who repaired the world.
is that what it's actually for? The Irina Sendler Award is for people who have repaired the world.
In 2006, the Polish nonprofit, I'm not going to try and pronounce that name, I'm sorry.
Sure.
It's Polish. But, and the Ministry of Affairs in Poland all worked together to establish, quote, the Irina Sendler Award for repairing the world, end quote. Awarded to Polish and American teachers.
Polish and American teachers, like specifically teachers.
Attitude and message of Sendler. Apparently it is specifically for teachers. Wow.
Well, teachers deserve more awards and, you know, I'm glad that exists.
Sendler prizes for teachers. Checks out.
It's this world that we live in, man, it's nuts. But I think our time is better served if we start talking about the environment. Because I think Al Gore would want to I don't, I mean, is it rude of me just to call him by his first and last name? Like, should I keep calling him Al Gore? Should I call him the former vice president? I don't know. Wish he were here for me to ask him. But yeah. I think the former vice president would want us to talk about environmental policy.
It is what he won his Nobel Prize for, getting people to talk about it.
Yes, absolutely. And that's really important, though. Like, it's really important that we have the intention to talk about the environment and the alarming trends and trajectory that we're on. I think that there's incredible value. Do I think that he should have won a Nobel Prize? No. He didn't deserve them.
Yeah, I don't know whether an inconvenient truth did help as much as the Nobel Committee seems to. And, you know, like certainly because no one else was doing it, he ended up being who we all talk about. But, you know, like the face of a recently beaten politician being the face of climate change super politicized it. And like there was the whole thing about he grew, you know, he like lost the election and grew a beard and then came back talking about there's something in the air that's going to kill us all. It was very not the best face for it, I think.
Well, his bearded face wasn't the best one for it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
I remember at the time I wasn't old enough to vote in 2000, but I do remember at the time thinking, oh, gosh darn George Bush, and also in the coverage afterwards, like people were like, this guy grew a beard and he's going to diners, and he must have lost it. The former vice president has fallen so far from grace because he likes to eat chicken fried chicken. Like, what's so crazy about that? I don't think that's so nuts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's kind of the natural political cycle for most politicians who lose their campaign. They usually just, you know, retire and fade into the background. And then to, like, come back from that, you know, like, it's hard to lose with grace, especially when Fox News is on the side of your opponent. So, like, of course they're going to be talking smack, but then to try and come back from that as the face of climate change, I think, was detrimental to, or was less helpful than if someone else had done it. But no one else was, so I guess he gets the award for being the only one that famous who cared that much.
Again, he was a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. He was a member of the U.S. Senate. He was frickin' vice president of the United States. Who better to do that? He saw the moment, and it's savvy. I think that who better than Al Gore? I'm proud of him.
Yeah. Reasonable. And I think I guess I've been unfair because he didn't do it for political gain. He hasn't used it to run for president again on the, you know, on the clout of his movie. He won awards for his movie, but he hasn't tried to use it to his own gain. And his professor was one of the actual first, you know, scientists writing, studying and speaking out on this matter. And so I think he went to school after he came back from Vietnam, and that's when he had a professor who was like, by the way, here's some crazy stuff, is that we're causing climate change. And then he like went and did his political career and got out of politics and was looking for a way to still help the world. And he was doing slideshows and he was just like any other retired middle-aged man who realizes he doesn't want to be retired and goes around doing slideshows, you know? But instead of selling real estate, he was selling a better planet. So good on him for trying. I appreciate it. But I think there have been like lots of scientific, what academy was it who disproved numerous facts out of an inconvenient truth, and just like the whole carbon dioxide theory when what is it, like methane is like a more pressing issue than carbon monoxide?
They just completely disproved the facts that were presented in An Inconvenient Truth, or like years later, they showed that what was presented was alarmist and not grounded in facts and truth.
Gosh, I don't have the sources open in front of me. This is stuff I remember, not from researching Al Gore, but from...
Sure. Well, you know, and also, you know, Malcolm, no worries, no worries on not remembering. I should be having this conversation with Al Gore, but the guy freaking stood me up. And so I appreciate you doing your best. Thank you so much.
About it. Yeah. Yeah, Mr. Gore, if you're listening, it is never too late to write in, send us a comment. Again, mybrilliantbuddiesfacebook.com is our most active. Also at Gmail. We'll have an Instagram up soon. Maybe a TikTok one of these days. YouTube. The whole shebang is coming.
And ordinarily we'd be able to receive phone calls, but after experiencing quite a few difficulties, them technical, we're re-recording this episode. And so... Mm-hmm. In your research, Malcolm, you know, you said you did a little bit of it, and I appreciate that. What was the most alarming environmental statistic that you came across? What scared the bejesus out of you?
Definitely that chart on when he, you know, when he goes up on the, in the middle of Inconvenient Truth, he's giving the slideshow, he's showing these charts, and then the line keeps going up. So he gets up on a cherry picker and goes all the way up to the top of the screen. Because the line is, like, literally off the charts.
Off the charts. I remember the chart. It went straight up.
Yeah. That really struck me because, so for the listeners who aren't familiar with the chart, it's three line graphs. One is CO2 concentration, parts per million in the atmosphere. One is global temperature. It is averaging at zero. So it's, you know, global temperature rise or fall by degrees Celsius, average temperatures. The other one is sea levels. So these three graphs that move perfectly in unison with each other. When one go up, the other two go up. Until most recently, in fact, just since the Industrial Revolution, carbon dioxide concentration has gone way up. The other two have yet to go up with it. What's crazy about it is carbon dioxide concentration, parts per million in the atmosphere, has gone up, it looks like 150 parts per million. Last time it went up 150 parts per million was the end of the last ice age, when temperatures rose by 4 degrees on average, sea level rose by 400 feet on average, carbon dioxide rose by 150 parts per million. Well, since the Industrial Revolution, it's risen that far again, and the temperature and sea level have yet to catch up. So fingers crossed that they don't, because it's like the difference between the mile of ice on top of Michigan and Canada, the glaciers. Last time this happened, glaciers melted, sea levels rose, society collapsed, you know, Noah and the flood and all that. Graham Hancock, that's a guest you should have on. Graham Hancock?
He's a brilliant guy. I would love to talk to him. I'd love to talk to him. That's really alarming. The parts per million in the atmosphere, the last time it was at these levels was at the end of the last ice age?
No, I'm sorry. The difference between the last ice age and right now, the difference between the end of the last ice age and the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So that 11,000 years, the carbon monoxide went up the same amount that it has gone up since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution until now.
Gosh, that seems scary. That seems really scary. Yeah. It seems as though it seems as though the, like you had mentioned, the temperatures are rising, but not proportionally to the parts per million. Sea levels are rising, but not proportionally. It just seems like overnight there's going to be this extreme catastrophic event that normalizes these levels, that where the sea level catches up to the CO2.
That is literally what happened last time, where the sea level rose 40 feet overnight by some accounts.
And what? Like, overnight?
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. It's a whole ass episode. I'm sorry. But, like, the way the ice caps melt, they create lakes. They don't just, like, melt and drip into the sea little bit by bit. They create a lake in the middle of the glacier. And then when the edge breaks, all of the water goes into the ocean at once. This is literally, this is the scientific backing of Noah's flood and the Epic of Gilgamesh and the river serpent that ate up the land, according to the Australian Aborigines. Like, every ancient culture talks about this event where the sea level rose, the world flooded, civilization ended, and they had to restart from, like, sticks and rocks, basically, you know? That's what happened last time the CO2 rose this amount.
That seems scary.
Not to be alarmist. We keep going at this rate, the ice caps will, the North Pole will be melted and not there anymore in like 50 to 80 years at this rate.
In 50 to 80 years?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, see, I'm not going to be alive. And so even if we stopped emitting carbon pollution 100%, like, you're saying that the sea level can rise, did rise by 40 feet overnight. If somehow we stopped emitting 100% of our carbon pollutants overnight,
straight to zero,
we still would feel the effects. We'd still feel the effects of global climate change and the decisions that we've made that have led us to this point over the next 100 years. And so if we're still going to feel the effects 100 years out, and people are predicting that the sea levels are going to rise and another catastrophic apocalyptic event is within the next 50 to 80 years, are we past the point of no return?
No, because that's part of the thing about an inconvenient truth. And how much it focuses on CO2. And then, like, the fallout from that was a lot of people, you know, like, went into this frenzy of, like, you know, if you turn off your lights for 5 minutes a day, you can save the planet. And it's like, no, it's really about the just, like, systemic pollution of treating the Earth like a sewer, you know? Al Gore loves his new catchphrase is treating the sky like an open sewer, and it's very catchy. And you know, the atmosphere compared to the Earth is as thick as the coat of varnish on a globe. Just like
I heard that. I heard him.
But that
I prefer to think of it like a little candy wrapper.
Reasonable. But the thing about fossil fuels and CO2 emissions is that that's the number one cause, but it's not at all the only cause. Like, agriculture, fertilizers, like the fertilizers we use are so chemical that they evaporate into the air and the land water, and just like the waste in landfills releasing methane. That's like, you know, people love to talk about cow farts. You hear that the Green New Deal is going to get rid of hamburgers because the liberals want to take away cow farts. But, like, genuinely, methane from agriculture is the second pollutant. So that's not CO2, that's methane. Methane from landfills is the third most cause of air pollution. And so even if we stopped burning fossil fuels, there are much deeper issues. And, like, those landfills are going to be there degrading and releasing methane until they're broken down into organic chemicals again, you know.
Yeah, and what's the half-life on a pile of plastic?
Yeah, so back to the question, would be there if we stopped? right? That's if we stopped. But
sure,
we can go backwards. There is a fungus that breaks down plastic into an organic chemical again. And it has been seeded on the trash continent of the Pacific, you know? So, like, it's a matter of time before that fungus can break down. And also whether we stop polluting faster than we can take it away. But there are also, like, carbon sinks and, what is it, carbon sequestering. And it's a whole branch of agriculture and industry that's all about taking carbon out of the air and locking it into, like, planting trees. Trees literally take carbon out of the air and turn it into their skeleton. That's what trees are made of, is carbon from the air. And then trap it, and then they die, and they lock it into the soil where other little plants can get at it and use it.
It's not just like planting trees, but also deforestation. This is so nuanced and so far-reaching. Like, how do we stop the big agriculture? How do you stop? How does culture change to a point where people want to eat less cheeseburgers?
Mm-hmm. That's where, like, a free market breaks down. You know, like, I live in a bus and I don't have a big budget. So I would love to eat organic, but, like, cannot afford it when I can get the exact same thing for half the price at Walmart. You know, like, as long as people are still allowed. And I mean, you know, like, as long as China is allowing its people to pay unreasonable wages and burn cheap fossil fuels in order to create all this little crippity crap that comes over and we buy it from Walmart, it's a lot to ask any random citizen, you know, to not do that compared to asking one damn corporation to step up and stop.
Sure. I question a lot about this. You know, I question whether we as a society have enough patience in today's sensational 24-hour news cycle. What have you done for me lately? I question whether we have the patience to enact change and not immediately feel the results and to stick with it. I question whether we have politicians, whether the divisiveness in Washington, the gridlock that we see on a national scale in our politics, is so divisive that we can't affect change.
Mm-hmm.
It feels to me a little end of days.
Mm. I think it's the nature of the world. I'm gonna say the nature of American politics, but it's just the nature of the world that, like, the politicians don't actually hold the power. The politicians represent the powers that get them elected. Like, you can trick half the country, you can trick more than half of the country into thinking that politicians, for lack of a better word, are pedophilic vampires, or, you know, like, all those conspiracy theories that are, like, really far out there. But you can't, like, you can only convince the people of that because of the shiciness that people try to pull off. You know, like politicians have gotten scummier and scummier, and the money in politics, like, everyone can tell that it's corrupt, and so no one agrees on how to get rid of corruption, because some people think it's blood magic, some people think it's Citizens United, and so the gridlock in Washington is a symptom of the gridlock between people who think it's blood magic and we need to go back to good old Christian days, and people who think it's money and politics and closed-mindedness and we need to go forward.
Mm-hmm.
Is a very crude breakdown. But everyone can agree that storms are getting worse, summers are getting shorter. You know, whether you're rural or urban, your crops are dying and getting hit by pests and plague, or your streets are flooding and your cities are burning. And so I think at this point, like, nobody wants a new coal plant in their district. You know, everybody wants new green electricity that's going to bring jobs to their county. And
it's an economic thing. It's driven by our public discourse, but this is economics. I think people will want coal or nuclear or wind power turbines or solar energy, so long as it behooves them and it suits their economic interests.
And that's the economics of it, is, you know, like, solar panels are crossing that threshold where it's literally cheaper to get solar energy than coal energy. So why would any industry not switch over to solar? The answer is because battery technology is very difficult and lagging behind. But, you know, like, everyone.
Well, and also there's been trillions of dollars of infrastructure that has been invested over the past 100 years. Now these big beasts of businesses that have personhood and buy elections and fund campaigns with dark money donations, so we can't see who they're giving it to and who's getting what money from whom, from which corporations. That's why I think that change is so, I'm so skeptical of change because of the powers that be and the amount of incredible power that they have.
Yeah, I just don't think the politicians aren't, they're not the captain of a ship. They're not steering the people. They are like the figurehead. They're like that sculpture on the front of the ship that is cutting all the waves, and maybe that sculpture thinks that it's because it's in the front it's controlling the boat, but it really isn't, you know. Like,
if people
aren't feeling a way, then you can't get elected. It does, you know, like, you can feel an election if it's close, but, and, you know, the whole working statistics to your favor and all that, but that's just math, you know. They don't invent the fact that 4 million people feel this way. They just play those 4 million people and their feelings. And
right.
It's, so, you know, like, you run into, like, these, like, corporate ads. You even see BP promoting its green energy. And it's like, screw you, BP. We all know that the P stands for petroleum. But at the same time, the fact that BP is trying to make you think they're green means that everyone thinks they're green. And I know everyone is a very broad net and a false term, but, you know, if BP is trying to make you think you're green, then everyone wants to go green. Even the oil industries want to pretend to be green. It's the way of the future.
I definitely think it is the way of the future. I think it's the way of the present. Not in our country. It's the, like, you look around the world and the electrification of transportation systems around the world, in Europe, in Asia, in other sections of the world, where they are absolutely creating efficient and healthy systems and standards for their people. Mm-hmm. And I think we're seeing a lot of talk. I just don't feel as though I'm experiencing on a day-to-day basis the change that we are talking about already being in motion, you know?
Yeah, I could see how you would, but you know, I was I'm not sure, but like,
I wish Al Gore were here to talk about it.
Yeah. I was going to say, I was born into the environmental movement. Like, by the time I start remembering stuff, and especially with my parents and who they are, like, I've been familiar with it. But it's even things like littering. And just, like, being a kid, littering was entirely an okay thing to do. And I don't think it was just from growing up and those kids stopped littering because they grew up. But, like, at a certain point, I feel like things like littering just became not all right. You know, even you see like TikTok videos that are just going off on someone because they threw a hamburger wrapper out their window. And it's just whether or not everyone cares, everyone as a society, we've agreed that this is needs to happen. And so I think that whether we have, I think to answer the question that this spun off of, no, people are not patient enough to enact public policy 10 years ago. But now that California is on fire all year round, New York is flooding, the South is being hit by devastating hurricanes, and the North is either buried up to its neck in snow or doesn't have winter anymore. People are like, no matter where you're at, you recognize that this is a problem for you, and it's too late to plan ahead. And so we are, it's too late to ask, do people have the patience to implement policy? Because no, they didn't. And so now we're reaping the consequences and trying to deal with it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really well said. And it leads me to ask, are there changes that we can make, you and I, whoever's listening to this, whenever they're listening to this? You know, is it as simple as switching away from single-use plastics and to paper straws? Does us changing our behavior and our consumption patterns and our economic decisions on an individual level, will that make enough of a change? How do we actually enact change that is going to make a difference in our trajectory? Because it really feels as though the separate your glass bottles from your trash, make sure you're recycling and using paper straws, it really feels as though that is a drop in the bucket for what is actually necessary to pull us back off the brink of annihilation.
I wish we had an expert's opinion on the matter.
Yeah, I do too.
This would be the perfect time to take callers. But as we mentioned,
this would be the perfect time.
Post-recording, because our live recording had many difficulties.
So many difficulties. You know, we've covered a lot of stuff. Do you have any final thoughts?
Doing everything you can. You know, but I do think that we as everyday citizens are very limited to participating in local government. That is where your voice is the loudest. And that's the kind of thing about, like, the president or the candidate for president can say, we're going to bring coal jobs back to Pennsylvania. But if the constituents of that county go in and make a fuss at their town halls, then that power plant will not open up in their county. And so if you care about where you live, then go get involved in local politics. It's the number one reason that I am interested in getting off the road and finding one place to live, is so that I can, you know, get involved in local politics. Grassroots. Strong trees, deep roots. The other thing you can do is vote with your dollar. And that has a lot less power, especially, Adam will tell you, the dollar has less power every day than it did the day before. Inflation and corruption and the whole shebang is all going downhill. But when everybody stops, even when everybody starts buying reusable grocery bags, then the reusable grocery bag market explodes and people start making reusable grocery bags. They get cheaper. They get more of them. You'll get fun patterns. You can get them customized online just because people said, this is something I want. I will pay my hard-earned money for this thing because I care about the climate, because I care about the trash island in the Pacific. I will go out and buy a grocery bag that is reusable. And that's the kind of vote with your dollars, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think that I think it's really interesting that you mention getting involved in local politics, actually going and showing up and making your voice heard. Because Al Gore, and I'm going to quote him right now, I wish he were here for this conversation, you know, but he said something really, I think, that speaks to that point. I can't understand why there aren't rings of young people blocking bulldozers. And, I mean, it's really well articulated. And the truth is that just getting involved is what is necessary. And I think that, you know, I don't think Al Gore deserved to win a Nobel Peace Prize for encouraging and highlighting the importance of these things, but it does make a difference. And I full-heartedly agree with you that the number one way that we can affect this change for our future and for generations ahead of us, if we make it there, because there may be 40 feet of water that just all of a sudden overnight, you know, if we get there, but it really comes down to our economic decision-making, what we do, how we spend our time and our energy, and how we construct our society around what is now a fiat system with dollar bills and moving forward with cryptocurrencies as an equitable way to distribute wealth. And if you want to get involved, go over to climaterealityproject.org. There are so many different ways to get involved. You can donate money there at climaterealityproject.org for those that are interested in supporting the work that they're doing to bring truth to the public discourse about how our climate is being changed every day and how it takes many lifetimes of effort, apparently, to reverse this, because even if we stop and even if we started pushing back and changing our behaviors, we're still going to be feeling the increase in temperatures 100 years from now. We're still going to see wildfires crushing California and parts of Australia. We're still going to see a rise in our ocean temperatures and a diminishing of our polar ice caps and of permafrost. And so it's just, like you said, it's about showing up, getting involved. And, oh, man, I feel like that's, like, is this enough? Do you think that we're doing enough by, like, bringing this conversation forward? I don't know.
No. I don't think that you can do enough in 1 hour. You know, like, there is no one thing that is enough. It's, like, continuous every day, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think we did great for only having an hour. That next week, Dr. Suzanne McDonald.
And Dr. McDonald is the world's leading expert on raccoons. And living in a metropolitan area, I live in San Francisco, and they're everywhere. I was outside last night. It was like 10 o'clock. And there were two huge raccoons just, like, sitting on the sidewalk. They were huge. Yeah. And I don't know what I'm supposed to do living in a city with raccoons.
I had a pack of raccoons last week, didn't you? Well, you'll have to come back to hear about it, actually.
I can't wait to talk to Dr. McDonald about the – I stumbled upon a raccoon nest in Golden Gate Park. There were 20 raccoons. And I had cookies on me, and I was really scared that I was about to be attacked for the sweets that were in my pocket. And so I tossed the cookies, and I ran. And I barely got away with Mo. Was I scared. And so, well, Malcolm, I appreciate you coming on, man. This is awesome. Thank you so much. I really enjoy, again, I enjoyed this. I wish the former vice president were here.
If you want to know a totally safe way to overthrow the powers that be, stick around and listen to Adam talk about crypto, though, because, you know, again, voting with your dollar and giving the power back to the people. He talks about the gold standard, the history of money, and how modern money is the modern money printing system just is stealing dollars from your pocket. Really interesting hour coming up next.
Super into expanding further, but we'll see which direction we expand into.
I know.
To wit, it's 5:55.
Yeah, it is.
Adam coming in soon? Should I hang up when he gets here? Am I just going to, like, you know, put me on mute and I can listen through my headphones, or should I be listening live? You know,
Malcolm, I'll never mute you. Don't worry, buddy. If you want a microphone, you just call me and I'll figure out a way to amplify you. No, it's interesting you would say that. You were like talking a couple times, and I was like so excited. I was like pointing. I was like smiling. We've been doing a little bit of work here in the studio. He walked into the studio. My brilliant buddy himself is now live with us. Adam Gitsis, everybody. Adam, say hi.
Hello. It's great to... You can't hear me?
I can't. My headphones stopped working once yours plugged in.
Oh, man. I can hear you.
Awesome. Well, it is great to be back at Mutiny Radio. I gave my shot at stand-up comedy here a couple years back, and got feedback like, do you know what a joke is? And
oh my God.
Are you funny? So it's great to come back at something maybe I'm good at. Very excited.
I saw that video. Like, you had recorded that and posted that, right? The video of you doing stand up at the thing?
No, it wasn't a video. It was on a radio show just like this.
Mm-hmm.
I did other videos.
Okay. Yeah. That was the last time you did stand up. That was the last time?
No, the last time I did it was an open mic on my birthday in Philly. My mom was in the crowd. My opener was great. I said, they say the best help for a comedian is a drunk audience, so I'd like to thank my mother for raising the average here. It just went downhill from there.
Reasonable. Pam, the lovely director here of Mutiny Radio, still does that comedy workshop on Mondays, which runs from 6 to 8 p.m. And so if you're interested in coming back and receiving, you know,
no,
more constructive
really
criticism,
harsh, yeah.
Yeah, receiving more constructive criticism, you can do that Mondays from 6 to 8. You can also come down for the Friday open mic, which is also from 6 to 8 p.m. And for those of you listening at home, here's a little bit of insider information. I'm going to be working the ones and twos. I'm going to be back here working the board from 6 to 8 p.m. to open Pam up so she can host it live from the stage where she feels more comfortable and it's a better production quality. So that way she doesn't have to be back here herself. Oh my God, Pam, my worlds are colliding. My brilliant buddy Malcolm and my brilliant buddy Adam are now talking in one place at one time.
Yeah, I'm excited to meet you, Malcolm. Chad said a lot about you.
Yeah. Hello, wow. Heard a lot about you, too. Constantly impressed by what I hear. You're out there killing it. And it's nice for you to meet me, but I've already heard and seen you on your live stream for Compass Mining.
Oh yeah, the spaces.
Yeah, yeah. I when you had that bushy mustache out at some global conference.
I love that mustache. That's my favorite. I have friends that grow mustaches. Malcolm, you know Strange. That man can grow a mustache. Adam's mustache.
Yeah, you can.
Being on the YouTube page of this startup company that's worth $1 billion is the funniest thing ever, right? There's these CEOs wearing polo shirts. They're tucked in and they're being interviewed, and it's the whole YouTube thing. And then Adam shows up and he's got this mop of a head of hair and his big old mustache and a smile that goes from chin ear to ear. You know, it's the cutest thing. I love
it's
so
great.
Much.
Well, so we were in Miami at the Bitcoin conference for that, and we went out pretty late the night before, and I hustled to get in in time for the conference. And I wish I could have spent a couple seconds fixing my hair, I guess, but next time.
Hey, you look great. Your mustache looks straight off like an 80s movie set.
Yeah, the mustache
you're
I am proud of, yeah.
It's a, you should be. We all are. So Adam, you weren't here. Next week, Vice President Al Gore is going to be in the studio.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's going to be here. We're going to be talking about a whole host of things.
Global warming?
Global warming being the most important one that we're going to talk about.
Well, Al Gore also invented the internet, so.
Oh, my God. And so didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay. When I research the interview for next week, I'm sure that that'll come up. And so he created the internet. What was that like?
Yeah. I was responsible for all of this.
Yeah. He created the internet and tried warning us about global warming. He's our first guest.
Yeah. Every time we lose power here in California, we can thank Al Gore for that.
Okay. I do. I do thank Al Gore. I thank Al Gore on a daily basis. You know, I go down, I eat pineapple chunks, and I'm like, you know what? Thank you, former Vice President Al Gore. I was going to ask, is there anything in particular that you're not in studio until 3 o'clock? He's going to be here earlier. He kicks off the show at 2. So you're just going to miss each other. Is there anything that you would like to ask him?
Well, I work in Bitcoin mining, and he's concerned about the environment. And one of the big arguments against Bitcoin mining is its impact on the environment. So I'd love to hear his thoughts. And if he is against Bitcoin and proof of work mining, I'd love to hear how he plans to finance the conversion of our energy sources from coal and oil to greener sources like solar and wind.
Can you write that up? Can you like write that up and send that in an email that was like multi-part?
What is your job, Chad?
What is my part? I'm taking active notes, okay? How about this? We directed our audience to the Facebook page. If they have any questions for Al Gore, go to My Brilliant Buddies on Facebook and please post it. And so, Adam, what is my job? What about your level of participation in the thing?
For the record, for those of you who are not in the studio, Chad's active notes was picking up a pen. I never saw it.
Created the internet right there. He created the internet. And then he's concerned about the environment.
All right, so what we need to do is teach Chad shorthand note-taking so he can get more words.
Please do. Please do it. Please teach me from years ago, like younger me. Like I have been having an ongoing conversation for those that are listening in 2027. Thank you again. By now, how about this? When I go back and listen to this in 2027, I hope that I'm able to be like, oh my God, I take such better notes.
You will
now
shorthand the entire thing.
The entire thing.
Real time.
Well, and also just all of my show notes are going to be shorthand, right? Even the title, show notes, it's just going to be shorthanded.
I think, yeah, I don't know how it works, but we'll figure it out.
I don't know how it works either. I'm excited to learn shorthand.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't even like the term shorthand. It's...
Was Al Gore in office during the Monica Lewinsky scandal? Because I'd also love to hear some personal anecdotes about what that
was. Yeah, Gore was vice president.
Like, did he know Monica? Because I'm sure the president and vice president don't, like, hang out with all the interns all the time.
Yeah, well, apparently they do. And also, do you think Gore's the one that leaked it? Right? And he was like, you know what? Yeah. Dick, Nixon, this is how Ford became president. There's no way that the Republicans are going to be, like, fair in an election. And I'm up next, and so...
Well, so Al Gore's a brilliant strategist, creating the internet and discovering climate change, so he probably did have that thought.
Maybe. That's a little cutthroat. That's a little House of Cardsian.
Yeah.
Yeah, very, very cutthroat.
Apparently everyone's like that over in D.C.
And so, Adam, here we are in studio. Malcolm, are you still there? Do we still have Malcolm?
I'm here. I've muted my phone, but I'm just listening on the headphones and available for...
Perfect.
What I might come up with.
I'm surprised you're on your phone. It sounds great.
It does sound great, right? And so, Malcolm, feel free to unmute yourself and join in at your discretion. Adam, what we were talking about earlier with Malcolm is that this episode zero is sort of like a brainstorming meet My Brilliant Buddies. What are we about? Who are these people? And I think, what is it that we're going to create here, right? And so we've been talking very openly about this gag that we're going to be doing. And so as the conversation now transitions into hour two, or at the 3 p.m. hour is our hour two, our intention here, you and I, and with this crypto, this conversation about crypto, is to educate non-finance or educate people who do not have backgrounds in finance and tech about the intricacies and the details of crypto.
I don't even think it needs to be the intricacies and details. Like, everyone's like, oh, it's a scam. Oh, it's a Ponzi scheme. Like, let's just start with the fact that it's important and it should be looked into. Because a lot of people don't understand that. They write it off immediately.
You think that a lot of people write off the importance of it because they don't understand? They're like, oh my God, crypto, Bitcoin, I don't get it. It must be a ruse?
Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
I mean, people don't like what they don't understand. Isn't there a saying like that?
I've heard that before. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Hey, I have a question. Who is the Bitcoin doodler?
That's me.
Yeah, you are the Bitcoin doodler?
I'm the Bitcoin doodler. I guess I'm doxxed now.
Yeah, well, sorry. Okay. My bad. Oops. I outed you.
My 7 YouTube subscribers will be happy to find out, I guess.
You will be happy to find out. I was on the Bitcoin Doodler's YouTube page. You have 10 YouTube subscribers, sir.
Back on there.
You have entered into double digits.
Yeah, triple digits is next.
And so, yeah, absolutely. The first video that you put on there was about the double spend problem. And now we're getting like a little bit further into the weeds than even I want to get today. But your idea...
pull back and go to the introducing Adam and who he is and why he's qualified to talk about Bitcoin, how you got to where you are and all that good stuff.
I think that's a lovely idea. Adam, so you are our subject matter expert, right? You're this brilliant man. You have worked in tech and now you work in Bitcoin. Can you give us a little history and a better understanding of who you are and why people, the tens of people that are listening right now should, and those in 2027 that are listening because we're fucking super famous. And so, why is it that people should listen and trust you as their source of Bitcoin information or crypto information?
Great. Thanks for the question, Chad. And thanks, Malcolm, for bringing it up and recentering Chad.
I need it. I need the refocusing. Thank you.
I've been working in tech since 2011, starting in the analytics space, and I spent 3.5 years at Amazon from 2017 to 2021. I first got into Bitcoin around 2017, and I dove deeper and deeper and deeper into it to the point where I sold any stock that I owned. I sold basically everything else, and I went all in on Bitcoin in 2019. And then in 2021, I found a job opportunity at a company called Compass Mining, mining Bitcoin and helping people to mine Bitcoin, and I just took the plunge. So my whole life is Bitcoin now, and it really has been for a while.
I mean, it sounds culty, you know, when you put it that way, where it's like every single nook of my life, professional, personal, how I'm personally invested.
The art that I have, the watch that I wear.
The watch that you're wearing right now, you know, it's, you know, you sold all of your stock? Like, you don't own any NASDAQ New York Stock Exchange stuff?
I still own a little bit of Amazon stock from when I worked there. But okay. That is it.
All right.
It's like 90% Bitcoin.
Okay. And so...
and Bitcoin miners.
Are you a Bitcoin...
Well, so I want to address this cult point.
A maximalist?
I am a Bitcoin maximalist, but I want to talk about the cult thing first.
Sure.
What we are doing with Bitcoin is we are completely reorchestrating society so that there is fair money at the root of it. Money is how we organize ourselves as human beings across the whole swaths of society. If it wasn't a seductive idea that many people could get behind and align themselves around, it wouldn't be prepared to take on that task. So while it is cultish, I like to think it's just an amazing idea that I want to see through, and other people, other like-minded people have that same concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like that you use...
And it is currently cultish, but... is moving towards more mainstream adoption and the kind of thing that in 5 years everyone is going to know about and probably use.
I mean, definitely.
Or it will be at least as ubiquitous
years.
As gold. Or maybe you don't own gold, but you recognize its value.
Right, exactly. Like, Bitcoin will replace gold. Bitcoin is gold for the digital age. And like the strength of the idea is why me and so many people, so many other people feel this way.
How, where in this life cycle are we? Like, I feel as though the train has already left the station and it is too far ahead of me. And I feel as though I can't hop on it yet. Like, I've missed the opportunity. Where are we at in the life cycle of Bitcoin, cryptos in general, that were I to hop in the game today, would I be too far behind? Would I be beating the curve by a bunch? Like, it feels, maybe because, like, you're my best buddy, one of my best buddies, and so I've been listening to you talk about Bitcoin for fucking 2 years. And so, I feel a little bit behind the eight ball. Where am I actually?
I mean, if you were to get started in Bitcoin today, you would not be behind the eight ball. I think there's 100 million people around the world storing their value in Bitcoin.
Only 100 million?
Yeah, and there's 8 billion people alive. So it's a very small percentage of the world using it. I mean, 100 million is nothing to scoff at. Like, Bitcoin has no CEO, no marketing campaigns, nothing like that. It's not a company, it's a thing. So 100 million is amazing, but this will be adopted by everyone. So we are very early. It's sort of like the internet in the early 90s.
It's still the early 90s internet.
Yes.
Okay. So Al Gore is still vice president.
So like with the internet in the early 90s, everyone was like, oh, this is kind of cool, but I don't know if I see the value in it. I don't know if it's going to, like, change the world or change companies. Like, Paul Krugman had an article, like, is the internet any better than a fax machine? And that's sort of, like, where we are right now with Bitcoin. Like, is this better than the dollar? Is there any reason to use this? That's most of the questions. Well, that's some of the questions that you'll still see today.
Right, and this being from people that are doubters of the adoption or just skeptics in general.
Yeah, mostly skeptics, yeah.
Sure. What about for maximalists like yourself?
Well, we just were here early, and it's a very clear path to Bitcoin being the main source of value. So our money today is broken because dollars can be printed by a select group of powerful people. And that means that if you have a dollar today, or let's say you got $12 today and you can buy yourself a nice burger in San Francisco, in 10 years from now, that same $12 will not get you a burger in San Francisco. It will get you much less than that.
Mm.
And as a result, people are storing their wealth not in their money, but in risk-bearing assets like stocks and real estate and bonds. They have to take on this risk in order to just stay in place, which is a horrible, horrible way for society to be designed. And what Bitcoin is going to do as fair money that cannot be inflated and cannot be debased by anybody is going to give us the ability to store our value over time without taking on that unnecessary risk.
Mm-hmm.
So the amount of Bitcoin today to buy a burger will be, I mean, if you have the amount of Bitcoin to buy a burger today, you'll probably be able to buy like 17 burgers in the future.
Sure.
But that's just because adoption's starting. At a stable space, the value of Bitcoin will remain flat.
And so the cost of burgers is never going to go up?
Correct.
Hypothetically.
Like, the cost of a burger doesn't go up. That's the amount of value of your dollar goes down. And I think people miss that.
Yeah, but doesn't that relative exchange happen? It's an opportunity cost, right? And so the burger costs $12, which is X percent of my rent that I pay that I don't pay every month, but the people pay every month. And so doesn't that relative value change regardless because of the shifting nature of economies? And how does switching away from fiat, away from a $5 bill or a $10 bill into these new cryptocurrencies, how does that change the economy from evolving in its price?
I'm specifically talking about Bitcoin. I'm not talking about other cryptocurrencies, and we can get into
that. Oh, yeah. My apologies.
But I will say, like, if you look at our economy and the human trajectory, things are supposed to get cheaper. Like, we are supposed to, we are more efficient over time. So what used to take a car used to take hours and hours to build. Now it takes an hour to build. Like, things get easier and easier. John Maynard Keynes, the architect of our current economy, expected us at this point in our societal life cycle to be working on average 10 hours a day, but instead people are working more and more overtime. And that's because of the debasement of our money making things more and more expensive. And
10 hours a day is what...
Sorry, 10 hours a week.
Okay, all right.
We should be working less because we're getting better as humans and we're getting more productive. Why are we working so much? It's because of the shitty money that we're using.
Sure. Is it because... I mean, that's one of the reasons that we're doing that. Also, the structure of... The entire beast that is the system, that is the government. And
well, like, when we have the ability to preserve our wealth over time, we should see a change in our values to reflect that.
Mm-hmm.
So right now it is like spend, buy, but that's because, like, what, I'm not going to save these $100 because they're going to be worth what is today $70. So.
Right. Fascinating. And so... You know, you're clearly brilliant. You know, I'm sure everyone now is in on the...
I mean, that's up to you.
Is in on the scene. Yeah. But, you know, the... So, rather, you're clearly...
I've thought about
this. Knowledgeable. Yeah, you've thought about this. Let me ask you this. What got us to where we are today with how the structure of our economy with dollar bills... How we are putting our energy and our future investments into these risk-bearing assets. Like, what got us here, and why is Bitcoin the solution to the entire process that we've been living up until now?
That's a great question. Go ahead.
So is that in particular the origin of Bitcoin? In the 2008-2009 housing crisis.
Yeah, it's a whole story. So I will start in 1936.
Awesome. Please do. I'm turning my microphone off. I can't stop laughing.
Hell yeah.
Okay, so from the 1800s until 1936, the world lived on a gold standard. Gold, unlike fiat dollars, but like Bitcoin, is hard to get. You can only get it from mining out of the ground or by taking it from other people. In 1936, the American government wanted to finance World War II, but they could not pay for it. So what they did is they actually said, everyone in our society, gold is now illegal for you to hold in your household. Bring your gold into the banks today.
What?
Under risk of getting thrown in jail.
What?
And we'll give you dollars that represent your gold that you'll be able to redeem after the war is over. But we need this now. It's a federal and national emergency, and we need to get in this war, and we need money. So they did that. And from 1936 to 1971, gold was illegal for people to hold.
Like bricks of gold or gold jewelry? Like, I have a bracelet that's gold. Would it have been illegal for me to wear that?
I am not 100% sure on that, but it was definitely gold as money was completely illegal.
Sure.
You had to give it to the government. And what they did, they basically made it so that people could not hold gold anymore. And then the global financial system after World War II was architected like this. Every $35 was worth 1 ounce of gold. And then every other country's currency was at a fixed exchange against the dollar. People couldn't exchange their dollars for gold. Regular people could not exchange their dollars for gold. But the central banks of our global across the globe could make that exchange. Now, what happened is that so many dollars were going out buying Toyotas and Volkswagens and things like that. That actually, it became clear to everyone in the world around in the late 60s, early 1970, that America did not have enough gold to maintain this $35 to 1 ounce of gold ratio, And the country that started to probe was France, and they were like, here's all the dollars I have, give me what it's worth in gold. And we started to panic because we didn't have enough gold, and we, us holding this peg of $35 to 1 ounce of gold was the, like, core of the global financial system. So Richard Nixon and a few of his cronies,
of course it was Dick Nixon,
in 1971, yeah, went to Camp David for a weekend. They're like, what are we going to do about this? And here was their answer. They told everyone to go fuck themselves.
also, I want to draw our attention to Malcolm's parents and grandparents are going to be listening to this. Okay. And while we are able to curse, I did the like old school, you know, like Will Smith
apologies add-on. To
that's
Malcolm.
Okay. No, I curse. Like it's happening. You're very passionate. I want to encourage that. I want to encourage that. Also, his Nana is listening, and so okay. And so back to Camp David. Richard Nixon. They come back from Camp David and say, "We don't care."
They said the promise that we had made originally of $35 for 1 ounce of gold is no longer in effect, and in fact, you can no longer redeem dollars for gold.
Oh, really? You're just not allowed to do it?
Yes. So now dollars are a standalone source of value, and everyone for some reason accepted this. Like, we didn't have a global war or anything. Mostly because America was financing its military and stuff by sending out dollars to buy for things that it didn't have the gold to back, like a strong military. So no one really wanted to question us there.
So let me get this straight. So for a long, when we wanted to go to war, and so we were like, okay, fine, if you are an American citizen and you have gold currency, blocks of gold, coins of gold, anything that gold is being used for as a with monetary value to buy goods and services, you got to bring it to the bank or else you're going to jail.
And we will give it back to you later, which
they said that. They said, did. Oh, yeah. My God, gaslighting. Yes. The United States is such a gaslighter. It's hilarious.
Yes.
It's not funny at all. And so this was in the 1930s. Fast forward, we go to war. Pew, pew. World War II happens, right? Everyone comes back.
We win.
Yeah, we won. Woo, yeah, we took care of Hitler. Also, there's a naval base that was made after World War II in San Diego that's shaped like a swastika, but we're not going to talk about that.
Nope,
sorry. Anyway, we won the war. Woohoo! Yes! And now we've got, since everyone brought in their gold, the entire U.S. economy is built on this gold standard, where the specific ratio is for every ounce of gold that you have purchased or you've brought to us, it is a $35 to 1 ounce of gold, right?
It wasn't the U.S. economy based on that. That was the global economy was based on that.
Oh, the entire globe's economy.
Instead of all countries storing their value in gold, they started storing it in dollars with the knowledge that $35 equaled 1 ounce of gold when they wanted it.
And this is the standard that the entire world's economy has, like, used the U.S. and our dollar bill as the foundational currency for the past century.
Well, so this was from the end of World War II till 1971 with Richard Nixon.
Right, 35 to 1.
Yep.
And then Richard Nixon and his cronies go to Camp David because France at the time was like, okay, cool, we've got all this gold, give us our money.
Well, we've got all these dollars, give us our gold.
Yeah, okay, thank you so much, I appreciate it. Yeah, I'm a dummy, you're my brilliant buddy, you're explaining this, thank you. And so, we've got all these dollars, we want the gold, we're French, please give us our stuff. And Richard Nixon's like, oh my God, this might start a run on things, this is bad, we don't have enough gold, let's go figure something out. And their solution was, no, we're not going to do that. And also, hey, American citizens, we told you were going to get your gold back. No, you're not. Yeah.
So after 1971, they did allow people to buy gold back. Okay. So you saw the price of gold in the 70s increase, I think, 10x. And it's like this wild historic moment where buying gold in the 70s is one of the best investments on record.
Okay.
Because they let gold had this suppressed price by the fixed exchange rate of $35 to 1 ounce, but it had a real value of something. I think it was like it ended up at like $200 or $300 per ounce. So
okay,
when you let the free market decide the value of gold, it was much higher.
Sure, because
people want fair money that cannot be debased.
Hmm. What is? I thought our economy was based on oil futures and oil, like crude oil.
So after 1971, we needed a way to keep the demand for gold or for dollars high, because that's one of our strengths. Is we have a strong, the dollar is expensive. It's a strong form of currency, which gives American citizens access to buy goods created in foreign economies for cheaper than they otherwise would be able to.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a couple of things. One was, instead of people storing value in gold, the central bank started storing value in promises from the American government to pay them more dollars than what they paid in. These are called U.S. Treasury bonds.
Treasury bonds, yeah.
And that is held by central banks all over the world. The second piece was, we needed to ensure there was continued demand, so we forced Saudi Arabia to only sell their oil for dollars, because oil is what powers the world. Everybody needs it.
For our cars, yep. And our heating our homes, yep. And for all the things.
So that's where we ended up today. That's why it's called a petrodollar system.
Oh, it's actually called the petrodollar? Yeah. Okay, I hadn't heard that term before, but I did know that it was based on petrol.
Yep.
And interesting. What's stopping the U.S. from saying, no, we're not going to do that anymore? And then changing the rules to the game like we have for the past now 80 years.
Well, so nothing's stopping them. That's why they
constantly...
So everyone's storing these dollars, but unlike gold, which again, you have to mine from the ground or win from other people through violence, with dollars, you can just freely print them. And what you do when you print dollars is you make all the dollars that everyone else has worked so hard for and earned so that they could save for their future, it makes them less and less valuable. So our government, when they do things like in 2008, where they bailed out financial institutions that I think we all agree are like terrible places and horrible for society.
Oh, they're scary. Oh, yeah, they're awful places.
So the government funded bailing them out by printing money, hurting savers across the world, including in America.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing that we could do to stop them.
Right.
So you're saying, like, if I were super rich and I have $2 billion saved up, and then the government goes and prints a $2 billion stimulus, my money is worth half as much as it was before.
That's not exactly half, but let's say your $2 billion is out of $100 billion outstanding, then you own 2% of all money. And then if the government prints another $100 billion, you own only 1% mm-hmm. of all money. So you've lost.
So were the global economy worth $2 billion,
right,
then everyone's money becomes worth half as much.
Yes, exactly.
How does Bitcoin – I know you're a Bitcoin maximalist. And so also other people love Dogecoin, you know. Other people are believers.
Well, we'll get to that in a bit.
And so why do you believe, and you're so invested, you've chosen to build your life around this professionally, you've invested your personal finances into this. How is Bitcoin specifically, how is cryptocurrency, and how is it the future? How is it the solution to this fiat problem that we have?
Okay, so there's a couple things here. The first is, society thrives when there is hard money backing it, like with gold, where you have to mine it or win it through from other people, from violence or the economy.
Mm.
That is a good thing for society. So the best times in the world were the Renaissance. There was a shared global monetary, not global, but... mostly global for that time period, monetary standard. Rome had a globally accepted monetary standard.
Sure, and Rome stretched the globe.
Yeah, and they were both gold-backed. But the failure of gold is that gold is heavy and it is hard to transact with, because you don't know if someone gives you gold. You have to run, like, tests. Is this real gold? Is this fake?
I thought you just bite it.
I mean, you can bite it.
It's got a specific,
that
like...
That doesn't seem uber scientific.
I've seen it in movies. What are you talking about? I've seen it. I just take a bite, you chip your tooth,
well,
and you're good.
What if you have stacks and stacks? You got to bite all the gold?
Yeah, for sure. Like, every square inch.
And in the modern pandemic, the way you're spreading germs, that's just not healthy.
And so...
Everyone biting their money.
And, yeah, seriously, you're biting your money during COVID? Okay, so... There's like the heart, it's hard to verify, and it is also hard to transport globally. Like, you need ships, you need planes, it's heavy. So what people have done in order to transact with gold is stored their gold in banks and then used paper forms of it, to make it a lot easier to transact, because paper is lighter than gold.
That's what the gold standard was.
Right, but that is where... That is where gold failed, because eventually they were able to say, like, nah, you can't have your gold anymore. And then it was like, nah, you're not even using this anymore.
Right.
And so Bitcoin is hard money because you have to work to get it by plugging machines in and solving this computational riddle or puzzle. So it has the same characteristics of gold in that you need to earn it by... doing economic activities or mining it, essentially.
Right, and we're considering actually, like, gold miner, like the gold rush gold miners, they were doing an economic activity by mining for gold. Right. And so this riddle...
But it's also
riddle,
like, I could cut your hair for gold.
Right,
yeah. So Bitcoin has the same thing. You can mine Bitcoin or you can earn it through goods and services. But Bitcoin has the characteristics to make up for the flaws in gold. Bitcoin's very easy to verify. Anyone with a $200 of hardware and a connection to the internet can verify all the Bitcoin that's ever been created since 2009. And Bitcoin is natively a part of the internet, so it can be sent globally. It can be stored easily. There is no tangible thing of Bitcoin, which a lot of people think is bad, but it's actually really good. Back in the Holocaust, the Nazis rounded up the Jews and they took all their jewelry and all the gold that they had. If the Jews in that time period were saving in Bitcoin, that wouldn't have been possible, because it's not like you can't take the secrets out of people's heads.
Well, aren't people using that? Like, refugees right now are leaving from war-torn areas and putting all of their savings into cryptocurrencies, because all they have to do is remember, what, 15 words or however.
It's 12 or 24 in Bitcoin.
Oh, my apologies. You're right. It's important. Thank you so much for correcting
me. It's refugees. There are women in the Arab world that aren't allowed to work or have bank accounts, who have started doing odd jobs and being able to take money in Bitcoin and store it on their cell phone. So that they have the ability to be independent and don't need to rely on men and can save themselves.
Awesome.
And so it's so frustrating to me when people say there's no practical use case. Like, yeah, sure, there's not, like, we don't need Bitcoin here in America, theoretically, if we want to accept the government debasing our money and things like that. But other areas where there's no banks or there's very little freedom, Bitcoin enables a whole group of billions of people to access the digital financial infrastructure.
To the timeline, can you continue telling us the story of, like, currency after the end of the gold standard and Nixon and what happened next and where Bitcoin actually comes in?
All right, so I will start the next phase of the story in 1980. So inflation was running rampant in the 70s. What that means is that basically the prices of everything was going up. It was mostly oil, and people weren't... And it was actually called stagflation, because normally when prices go up, that means unemployment goes down. But in the 70s, unemployment was up and inflation was up. So the quality of life was taking a real beating. And to get out of this, what the Federal Reserve did was they raised the interest rates on the U.S. treasuries to be like, here's an opportunity, something that you can do with your dollars that doesn't add to the economy. Let's slow this whole thing down, stop prices from rising, etc. So interest rates were in the double digits, which is something. It's good for savers. It's bad for borrowers. And ever since the 1980s, because we control our money and low interest rates are good for spending and borrowing, we have consistently just lowered interest rates. Under a gold standard, interest rates are based on a country's ability to pay back the loans that they're taking out. So if a country has high risk of not being able to pay back the debt, their interest rate goes up. And if they're not risky, their interest rate goes down. But when the U.S. is borrowing in a money that it can print itself, that trade-off doesn't really exist. There is no risk. So they set the interest rates by themselves. And because low interest rates are good for political reasons, get the economy spending, what we've seen is interest rates drop and drop and drop. And that risk-free interest rate is what people use to save without risk. And what happened, this gets us to the mortgage crisis in 2008. Pension funds, these large pools of capital that needed certain interest rates in order to meet their obligations, they were seeking ways to find that extra yield. And this new amazing tool that the regulators approved and said was basically risk-free emerged, the mortgage-backed securities. The mortgage-backed securities had the same risk-free status, according to regulators, as U.S. Treasuries, except they gave a much higher yield than U.S. Treasuries. So everyone in the world was like, holy shit, I gotta get these. And they poured their money into these mortgage-backed securities thinking they were risk-free. And that's where we ended up with the housing crisis, because mortgage-backed securities are, you're essentially buying mortgages. And this led to an incentive structure at mortgage companies, which I think Chad will actually be able to talk to.
I can certainly.
He was a little bit a part of this.
You were a part of this too.
I was towards the tail end, but
me too. What are you talking about? We're the same age. What are you talking about? We worked at the same place for the same guy for different amounts of time, but like, man.
All right, but there were incentives for mortgage brokerages to get mortgages created, and what that led to was one. Inflated house prices, because it was so easy to get mortgages that you could buy houses for a lot higher money but a lower monthly cost.
Another reason why it was easy to inflate house prices was because appraisers at the time were incentivized to raise the value of houses, so that way there was more equity in the value, so that way people could refinance again.
Yep.
Right, and so it was just like, let's jack up that price. Like, you paid extra money for an extra $250,000.
The mortgage companies also offered zero principal loans, so you could just pay a monthly interest payment as opposed to ever actually paying down the house.
Mm-hmm.
And it got so bad, there were even loans that required no documentation or proof of income.
These are very real things. They were no doc loans, and so regardless, you didn't have to do a verification of employment, you didn't have to do a verification of income, you didn't have to do a verification of assets. These are VOEs, VOIs, and VOAs are very real, very standard things when applying for a home ownership.
So I just walk into a bank, say I got nothing, but I want a house.
It's like, even yeah,
buddy,
it's
here you go,
Malcolm. No, it's even call. Better than walking into a bank. It's I'm gonna call Jim's mortgage company around the corner, and not the guy who owns it, but someone who I was 19 at the time. 18. Wait, it was 2008. Yeah, so the crisis was in 2008, right? And so. This was right when we graduated from high school, so it was back in 05, 06. What's up, Lower Morgan class of 2005? Anybody who's listening, I love you so much. Thank you so much. And so, I'm 18 years old at this time selling. Malcolm, I'm not kidding to you. I was talking to appraisers saying, hey, I need an extra $30,000 on this guy's value for his house, so he'll get approved
to 120% of the value. I was getting people 120% loan to value. So if their house was worth $100,000 for with no documentation, no verification of income, assets, or even employment, they'd be able to buy a house and then refinance it to 120% of its actual value. And the actual value of it was inflated because
18-year-old Chad said it's worth $30,000 more than it was when they bought it.
And so
they called Jim's mortgage.
And so please, Mr. Appraiser Man, we all want to make money, don't we?
So, yeah, so this was all happening while the pension funds and the workers that were contributing to these pension funds, they have no idea. But the quality of the mortgages backing the mortgage-backed securities was degrading rapidly. So they're taking on more and more hidden risk that they don't know about. And eventually this came to a head where there weren't any more home buyers at these highly inflated prices. And homes started to go down. And what happened then was a lot of people were leveraged to the hilt, like Chad was saying, 120% of the home value, and they couldn't pay their mortgages, and they couldn't sell the homes, and the bank couldn't sell the homes for what they had lent out. So there was all this money that was promised, but there wasn't a way to pay it back. Now, in a normal economy, where if money was real, if money was gold, and scarce and limited, what would have happened was basically, I don't know, we would have come up with some way to distribute these resources. There would be bankruptcies, and the law would take place. But instead, we have the ability to print money, and that's what we did. We didn't save the people who took on the risk and owned the houses. We saved the banking institutions that were holding these bad bonds, because that's the way that our government works. It is for the powerful. So we printed money. We saved the banks. We left the regular people with these homes they couldn't afford or being kicked out onto the streets, and we called it a success. And it was insane.
Oh my God.
And this is what led to the whole Occupy Wall Street.
Exactly.
And
so Malcolm, you're great.
Isn't he just a wonderful human being?
And this would be like a third as good if you weren't helping with keeping us on track.
That's what I'm saying. So this is the life that I live, Adam. You know, like when you're not around, it's Malcolm keeping me on straight. Malcolm, just know when you're not here, like it's Adam filling the shoe. Like I wouldn't be able to function without the two of you adjacent to me. Thank you so much.
So everyone could feel and like sense that this was wrong and that our quality of lives were poor. And that's why people hit the streets for Occupy Wall Street. Occupy Wall Street, I believe, started late 2008, early 2009. Don't quote me on that, but I think. And around that same time, a similar movement was starting, except it was technical, and it had the actual ability to fix the problems.
Mm-hmm.
Because the people in power will not listen to a bunch of protesters, but we can just ignore the people in power by choosing our own money. And that's when Bitcoin was created. The first block of Bitcoin was mined by the creator of Bitcoin, and in it he said, the Times says that we are on the brink of a second bailout. And this is deeply embedded in Bitcoin's ethos, is it is fair money, sorry Malcolm's family, that no one can fuck with. Because that's what we need in order to run a fair society is fair money. How can we be treated equally when the government has the ability to print money and we all work for money? Like how can we be equals? The government is supposed to be for the people, by the people, of the people, and that's not possible today.
Right.
For the financiers, by the financiers,
yes.
Of the financiers. Yeah.
Exactly.
Is what it's been since the 30s. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so
then the creator, this anonymous person by the name of Satoshi Nakamoto, if I'm correct,
yep,
created just what he like. What is Bitcoin? Is it a website? Is it a computer program? Is it what did Satoshi Nakamoto create? What did he do?
Great question. So Bitcoin is many things, and it's hard to describe, and I'm definitely not going to be able to cover it all in the next.
We have 17 minutes.
We'll have to come back weekly and talk about it, I guess.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, my brilliant buddies. Oh, my God. I love that this is the first conversation the two of you are having, and, like, you're both giggling. Oh, my God. Like, you're giggling. Great question. Like, I'm, at, like, observing this, and I'm sitting on at the edge of my seat, just, like, observing my brilliant buddies coming together.
I hope the audience is enjoying it as much as I am.
I you know what? I hope so, too, and honestly, I'm indifferent. Like, right now, this is the world to me. And so please continue, you both.
All right, so Bitcoin is sort of in part a protocol, which is a way for people to communicate over the internet. Well, a protocol is just a set of standards. So a protocol is like the way outlets work in the US and why everyone uses the same plugs, or how people plug into their phone with the USB-C. But Bitcoin is a protocol for how people can store and send Bitcoin over the Bitcoin network.
That's a lot. That's a lot in the same sentence.
Bitcoin a lot.
Yeah, yeah, you did.
Sure. Okay, so
we'll work on it. That's okay. Yeah. Keep going. Yeah, keep going.
In the protocol, there are rules for what it takes to mint Bitcoin, to send Bitcoin, and to hold Bitcoin. There is also rules for what it takes to run a node. Nodes are the heart of the network, and they are the machines that accept the transaction. So if I want to send Bitcoin, I submit a transaction to a node, and that gets passed around to all the other nodes on the network until it eventually is mined into a block. And I know I'm skipping ahead a lot.
It's okay. We'll get there.
Yeah.
This is important. This is important, like, that you're putting it into a sentence.
But what's important is that, there are roles on the network. A network is just a medium of communication. There are roles on the network, and together those roles run Bitcoin. Now, I guess the simplest way to describe Bitcoin, I'll give this a shot, is it's a ledger that the node store, or that anyone could store, that keeps track of who owns what Bitcoin. And all we are fighting for is the ability to maintain this ledger, to know who owns what Bitcoin, and to add records to it, to be able to say, the Bitcoin that I own, now I've given it to Chad. That is all that it is.
And how is that? It's no different than when somebody makes public their Cash App, like, stuff, right? Somebody sends... Like, I have friends that use Cash App that are like, cheers, drinks from last night, ha ha ha. That's a ledger. And so I know that there's a lot of people who are concerned about the public nature of the ledger of Bitcoin and how, oh my gosh, I don't want people to know my business, that who I'm transacting with. But we're already using it in practice. Venmo, Cash App, we're experiencing this in real time.
Venmo and Cash App a little bit. Venmo and Cash App are also ledgers. The difference between Venmo and Cash App and Bitcoin is that Venmo and Cash App are closed ledgers. They do the same thing. They keep a record of who owns what, and that record can continually change. The difference is that Cash App alone or Venmo alone, it can see all the records and can contribute to changing the records. Mm. Whereas on Bitcoin, anyone in the world can see the records on Bitcoin. And anyone in the world can contribute to adding new records to the Bitcoin ledger. And that is the core difference. Bitcoin is open and transparent and fair, whereas all of the current digital dollar systems are closed silos owned by individuals. Now, a benefit of being open and transparent and fair is that you don't need to communicate with other ledgers. So have you ever tried to put your money from Cash App or Venmo into your bank account instantly?
Yeah.
Because it costs money to do it instantly.
Yes, it does.
That's because the ledger that is Venmo, which is closed, needs to talk to the ledger that is your bank, which is also closed. And how do they do that, I think, is Chad's next question.
No, that's not my next question. There's a third party that does that, isn't there?
There's a third party.
And they're also closed, aren't they?
Well, it is an open protocol, but it's horrible. It's called the Automated Clearinghouse, ACH. You may have seen like ACH transfers. Now, this was created in the 1950s as a way to handle interbank financial exchanges. And it has remained in the 1950s. So it is a digital program, but it only works on weekdays during business hours.
No, stop
even,
it.
Even though it is digital. It's written in a language called COBOL, C-O-B-O-L, that no one uses today anymore. It's completely...
antiquated.
Yeah. But because...
like telegraph.
Yeah. But there's no competition to the ACH because it's got regulatory capture. So like I couldn't start an ACH, which means that it's allowed to continue to work this way.
And it's a monopoly. And this is who profits from the ACH? Like who is it privately owned? Is this an entity of the banking system?
Yeah, I think
of the
it's
government.
I think it's a collaboration of the banks.
Isn't it a problem that you've like listen to how intelligent and well knowledgeable you are, and this one integral thing for all of the transactions that occur between Venmo and your bank instantly.
And all your banks.
And all the banks. You think it might be a collectively owned thing by the banks? That's a problem. That it's like that. Yeah. It's
opaque.
That's the perfect word for it. Opaque.
Yeah, I mean, this is a problem. And that's why our digital payments are so horrible. I run the website of Compass Mining and
hot stuff. No, I run the website.
I bring this up because we've had trouble with our payment providers. We were using Stripe, which helps us process credit cards. And at some point they were like, no, we don't like what you guys are doing. So you need to find another payment processor. And now we use Square and they stopped supporting some of our payments. But those are companies that have built an interface into the ACH system, into the credit card system.
Mm-hmm.
And because these are closed and complicated systems, like you have to work with one of them.
Adam, so we have 10 minutes left.
One more thing.
Yeah, please.
When we accept credit card transactions, we charge people an extra 2.9%. We don't take that fee ourselves. That fee goes to the credit card companies just for the right to process the transactions, just for them to update a record in their database.
They charge almost 3 points.
I have to pay the credit card company so that I can pay you.
Yes. It's wild.
Nominal.
I mean, it's really...
Bitcoin prevents all of this.
A credit card company.
Yeah, no, like how brilliant a system are for like those white men were that they created this thing. Like this is so well constructed for those who receive the benefits of it.
Yeah.
This is so complete. This is so global, like holistically involved in our financial every transaction. We've got 9 minutes left. And I say that just because I could listen to you talk about this all day. And I'm so excited for us to now be doing this episodically and coming back on a week-to-week basis.
Yeah.
What are your goals and your intentions with this time? It's obviously to educate, but can you speak a little bit more specifically as to why it is that you're choosing to speak into a microphone at this time about this stuff? And like, what is it that you would like this conversation, what do you intend with it? How do you intend for it to be actionable for people?
I want people to participate in Bitcoin, whether that means downloading the Cash App and buying some, downloading a wallet on your phone and self-custodying that Bitcoin, just learning about Bitcoin, telling your friends about it. Eventually, I mean, my end hope for society is that we have a fair money that underlies everything, that we can, so we can have a fair world that where we are all treated equally because our money treats us equally. And I'm out here just spreading the message and letting people know why I think this is so important so that hopefully they'll stand up and start organizing and start fighting against everyone. start fighting against the government and the people in power. In the 1700s, the revolution that happened was the separation of church and state. The church was in charge of society, basically, and they got to rule arbitrarily. Where we're at today is the people who control the money get to rule arbitrarily. Like, they can bail out the banks without us caring. This year, or last year, they bailed out the airlines. I hate the airlines. They should be out of business. They should be replaced with better operators. All they've done is make planes worse. The seats are smaller.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
It's a horrible experience flying
an
airplane.
And our government is bailing them out because they can afford to, because they just print the money against the will of the people. And I want to fight that. Like, sure. We can beat that if we don't accept the dollar and we start using Bitcoin. Like, we'll win. They can't stop Bitcoin.
Oh. Okay.
Oh, yeah, separation of money and state.
Yeah, that's it. That's what I was talking about. Thanks, Malcolm, again.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's on the list.
Did you see the list?
They keep me around for?
Did you see the
list? Yes, I saw the list. Okay. But yeah, that's what this is about, the separation of money and state. Like, if they can't print money, then they can't do stuff without us lending them the money or without us giving them the money in taxes.
Awesome.
It's rad.
It's a very exciting time.
Very exciting.
That the existing system worked for a very long time, but we are at the end of that time, and we need to re-architect things, or, like, you're starting to see, like, there's lots of bad stuff happening in the world. Like, Donald Trump being elected is probably a symptom of society being ill because of the poor money, and we can fix this.
Donald Trump becoming president is certainly, like, is absolutely a symptom of society being ill. And this is just...
It's also a symptom of anti-establishment, you know? Like, people who are mad, just like we are mad at the establishment, but they're on the other side of the fence, so they go their direction.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't blame people for voting for Trump when he said he was going to drain the swamp. I'm in favor of draining the swamp. I wish he had. But
right.
I don't blame
him. I understand what you're saying, and I agree with you. And also, it feels as though Adam and, like, we're talking about, like cultural values that are a result of the beast that is the government guiding behaviors into believing certain things, and thus having such a strong influence over our lives. And it begins with our experience with the dollar bills, with money and currency.
I mean, that's why you see people upset on the left. Like, to the left, Biden's not left enough, and to the right, like, the candidates aren't right enough, except for Trump. Like, it's the same thing. People are just upset, and they're looking for solutions. Mm-hmm. And we actually have a solution here. Bitcoin is the solution. We just need to adopt it, and that's why the government will do everything they can, like, promote Dogecoin, like, Dogecoin's getting talked about on SNL. While no one talks about Bitcoin, this is for a reason. They're trying to stop us, but Bitcoin is the answer, and we're going to win.
You are a Bitcoin maximalist, and we're coming up on the edge of the end of time. And so why don't you just real quickly talk about what you just nibbled at, right? Where Dogecoin, these other coins are, they're a farce.
Can we
in Bitcoin.
Save that for next week?
Yeah, sure. Let's save that for next week.
Get involved and really have an active debate about the Bitcoin maximalism that can't be squeezed into 4 minutes.
That's
2 minutes.
That's so reasonable. Fine, we've got 2 minutes. I have a question. You two just had a conversation with one another for the first time. You know, I've raved to you, Adam, about my buddy Malcolm and how prepared he is. and Malcolm, I've talked to you at length about Adam and his brilliance and how he's my oldest friend. 26 years now I've known this guy.
Yeah.
And so you guys just met each other for the first time. You guys just had a conversation for 52 minutes. And so what are your thoughts?
I think we got something here.
Malcolm, what about you? Do you think we have something here?
Yeah, I could continue this conversation for hours and hours, but I figure we should save that for next week so that the audience can be part of it.
And so, audience being part of it, we talked about this. Again, if you're listening to this, email mybrilliantbuddies@gmail.com. I promise, if you email mybrilliantbuddies@gmail.com right now, and it's 2021, and you listen to this first show, and we ever monetize, I promise I will give you something. I promise I'll print you out some OG memorabilia.
Like before the second show.
Yeah, anytime. Absolutely. Yeah, it's got to be
before. Email us, follow us on Facebook. Please let us know what you want to hear more of. Did you like me and Adam's conversation, including Chad? I think it was, I liked it.
That's 100% what it was.
And please let us know. That first episode, we need to know where to go.
That's 100% what it was. It was like Malcolm and Adam having a conversation with a little spice of Chad, like including Chad. I'm working dials, and that feels I feel comfortable with that. And so
yeah,
I'm gonna send us out with a little bit of music. Thank you so much, Pam. Thank you so much, Mutiny Radio. None of this is possible without the hard work of Pam Benjamin, who is the director here at Mutiny Radio. Thank you so much. Thank you so much to my oh my god, I don't even know how to do this. Malcolm Harris, my brilliant buddy, who right now is on the East Coast in North Carolina. Do you have anything to say to the people before we sign out?
Gosh dang, I'm excited. Tune in next week to keep hearing me have fun. And if you don't tune in, I'll have fun without you. But please do, because that's where we get the approval to continue.
Adam Gitsis. Adam Gitsis, my brilliant buddy who's in studio here with me in the beautiful Mission District of San Francisco. Do you have anything that you want to say to the people before we leave?
Just looking to be open-minded to Bitcoin. And thank you, Pam.
All right, well, that is our time. Thank you, everybody who's out there listening, everybody with your kind words of support. Thank you, Malcolm. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Pam. Toodaloo. We'll talk to you next
week.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you, Chad.
We'll talk to you next week.
Concede true deception and multiply the million fold. Visualize the yin and yang in a battle so intense that we get them confused. The resident evil specializes in misconstruing. We want to be at a presidential level. What are we doing? Fooling ourselves, clowning ourselves, playing ourselves, but not being ourselves. We can't babble no more than we can bob our head off beat. Nimrod by the time we 40 because we can't get off meat. Why we ask no reason for the misplacement of the season. Look at the picture that's painted, tainted as a mind that's blinded to the point where sodomites get all the rights. We fall for fights with fisticuffs, get pissed enough to miss the bus. It disgusts me to see my folks run up on. I say stand up on the section of time, Mark.